Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Alert All Corporation is a family-owned and operated business founded in 1974. Alert All offers fire prevention and safety education products to fire departments, county and federal governments, and companies and corporations that sponsor and promote fire safety education. Alert All offers a variety of exclusive character lines such as Freddy Firefighter, Cappy Fire Dog, Today's Heroes, Fire Safety Extreme Team, Kid Rad, and Tot Finder, all of which are registered trademarks that appear on coloring books, fire chief hats, and our popular fire safety school kits for children preschool to sixth grade. For free information and samples, please call 1-800-253-7825 or visit our website at www.alertall.com.
All right, very good. This is a live podcast of fire and life safety education and prevention live from the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland. It's July 24th, 2009. We have a great panel today of people that are going to talk passionately about what they do in regard to prevention at home and concerns that they have for fire and life safety throughout the country. And I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves and give a short bio, basically up to about 1 minute. And I'm going to start on my left with Billy Hayes.
Hi, Billy Hayes, Director of Community Affairs for the District of Columbia Fire and EMS Department, also the National Advocate Manager for the Everyone Goes Home program through the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation.
I'm Bill Delaney with Montgomery County Fire Rescue, and I manage the Fire and Injury Prevention Programs for our department.
Daniel Byrne, I'm the Fire Marshal at the City of Beaufort Fire Department, South Carolina, and oversee the Education and Building Inspections Fire Prevention Program.
I'm Patsy Ann Macitti. I'm with the City of Alexandria, Virginia Fire Department. I'm a Fire and Life Safety Educator. I'm also the current president of the Virginia Fire and Life Safety Education Coalition and a member of Virginia's Department of Health Injury Prevention Network and Planning Group.
And I'm Mike Love. I'm the Fire Marshal with Montgomery County, Maryland, and have a very big interest in this whole area of fire and life safety education. We also have a few people in the audience that may at some point in time want to come up and talk about some of their programs as well as some things that they're aware of that are going out throughout the country. We have folks from U.S. Fire Administration here, Sandy Fasinoli and Teresa Neal, who will talk about some of the interesting things that are going on with USFA as well. Let me start off with talking about the big thing on everybody's mind, and that obviously is the economy. I don't have to say that it is impacting fire services. That impact is certainly taking away sometimes valuable resources, and we know that even prior to this occurring, we were all struggling with the dollar and trying to get the most out of it to deliver fire services as well as prevention. But let me start off asking each of you about your programs and how they may have been impacted staffing-wise or other resources or the fire problem as it might relate to this. Let me talk to Dan. Why don't you tell us from your area what kind of impacts it's had on you?
It's had a pretty dramatic impact. My office consisted of myself and the assistant fire marshal, and we had a pretty dynamic program. He addressed building construction and codes and plans review and inspections, and I took care of the education. If you could have the most fire-safe building in the world with all the resources available, but if the people aren't trained on how to maintain that and utilize those resources, it's kind of an endless circle. So we had a dynamic program, but they've redistributed the middle management, which we were. So he's gone on to something else. So I'm just back down to me. I'm just doing education and inspections and plans review and all of the above. So it's naturally going to affect the amount of programs that we can deliver. On the high note, though, the city council met when they were looking at the budget cuts, and they gave priorities to every department. And they said the top three priorities for the fire department, and I'm pretty proud of this, is one, put the fire out, obviously, and then education and inspections are the top three things that they want their fire department to continue to do. So I hope when the economy turns back around that we'll be back up and staffed.
Now, how about in regard to the types of fires, are you seeing anything different now that people are more cash-strapped? Certainly wintertime and the heating season, they may be going after alternatives for keeping warm and that kind of thing. Is there any changes that you've seen because of the economy in your area?
Absolutely. We've had a pretty significant fire last year, and it was just like you had described. She was in a rush to get to her second job, making dinner for the children, rushing around the house, got the children off to the babysitter, left for her job, and forgot to turn off the stove and set her apartment on fire. So we are seeing a small rise in that. Just inattention. People are, when you're worried about paying the bills next month, you know, using candles or all other alternative means to heat and light your home seem like a natural thing to do. So I think we're starting to see that, and I think it's going to continue.
Okay, thank you. And Bill Delaney, in your area in Montgomery County, Maryland, how has this had an impact on you? Or also, I'm aware that you are involved in the metropolitan Washington area with a group. Talk about others that may not be present here that have had an impact as well.
Yeah, actually, I failed to say I am the chairperson of the Washington Metro Region Life Safety Educators, and we've seen a huge impact there. Several departments have cut their public education staff by well over 50%, some pretty well-known departments. And there's two departments now in our region that no longer have a dedicated public educator, which of course, I think we all agree is very, very sad. You know, fortunately, in our department, the only impact we had is our chief. Well, you took a stand too there as the fire marshal, but our chief also made sure that there were no cuts there. Of course, we had on the books an opportunity to get a senior outreach person for elderly because we had a problem with a lot of seniors passing away in fires. Unfortunately, that's probably at this point our casualty as we've been unable to hire that. And but also in another local jurisdiction, they've taken several of their public educators and actually train them in Inspector One. And as you can well imagine, it generates revenue, so most of their time now is being spent doing fire inspections.
So a lot less in the way of outreach and more in the, the whole inspection issue needs to be taken care of as well. And as Dan mentioned, it becomes more and more of a challenge. But we're seeing maybe a prioritization in the minds of the fire chiefs, and if they're not aware of the adage of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, as Benjamin Franklin said, that they may pay the cost later.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we could go on a whole another tangent here, but of course, I think it just shows, and just some of the things I've seen around the country, let alone our area. There's not a good culture within the fire service to prevent the fire, and that's just the reality of the situation. And I think, you know, that's probably got to start, and we're all to blame at the end of the day, and we've got to do a better job of really promoting what it is we are doing and the worth of it. It is one of the life safety initiatives for the Everyone Goes Home program, but it's the one that is often ignored and forgotten.
Well, and before we started talking here, I was talking with Dan, and Dan had mentioned that that actually you talk about culture. The requirement for fire prevention type objectives in the firefighter basic training has actually been removed. So they're not even getting, unless you specifically identify that as an objective in your training programs, it's now no longer a standard. Then, if your community needs it, then they may not get it.
Well, the one thing, if I can interject, actually, the one good thing there is what we did in the Washington Metro Region and we've done in Montgomery County is, as part of a probationary firefighter's requirement, they are required to take the National Fire Academy's online Q118 course as part of their probation. So if they do not complete that, they don't attain permanent status. So that, and that's a free resource out there too. That doesn't cost a dime other than the recruit, rookie, probationer, whatever you call them, firefighter's time. And of course, it's a little bit easier to implement with a career fire department, or career staff. But certainly that is a, just jumping ahead a little bit, that is a free resource that's out there. While it's not a total replacement for recruit training, at least it's something.
Excellent. And Billy, Billy Hayes, it's interesting the dynamic that of course you're working for a fire department and responsible for outreach and educating the public, but you also have this other endeavor working with the fallen firefighters and safety issues there. And first, obviously, I would like to hear some things about DC Fire Department and what kind of things you do. And I'm very aware of a lot of things that you're doing, some really good programs. But you've also had some pretty critical losses this past year in some significant fatality fires. But also, if you could talk a little bit about that, but also tell us a little bit about how maybe prevention, especially education, can work with the 16 life safety initiatives of the fallen firefighters.
Sure, Chief. Thanks for having me with you this afternoon. We have taken some losses, both financially and by life as well. In this budget, this fiscal year budget, like everybody else, we've taken some pretty stern hits. We lost $200,000 in our smoke alarm project. We call it the Save You Smoke Alarm Verification and Utilization Program. $200,000 funding, which supplied the crews, the companies, and our public educators with smoke alarms to distribute. Like everybody else, we found that over 50% of our fire fatalities occurred in homes without a working smoke alarm, so the trend continues there. But without that funding, now we've had to go to alternative funding. Fortunately, we found a great partner in ACORN. I know everybody says ACORN, the voting, but they've actually been a great partner with us in the community. And they just provided us well over 700 smoke alarms that were almost completely out in about a three-month time period. So we've had to look for those alternative fundings. We are at 16 fire fatalities for this year in the District of Columbia as of July 24th, which is today. We had seven last year. So we're up to 16 already this year. We had six on New Year's Day. That's how we started in our new year with six fire fatalities. We had another multiple fatality fire right at the day after the presidential inauguration. The trend continues. So we're trying to make every effort in the District of Columbia to get out into the schools, which has been difficult for us to work with the schools. We found an ally with the public schools now. So that's hopefully going to yield some results with the National Home Safety Council being in Washington, D.C., as well as the U.S. Fire Administration only an hour up the road, as well as I know Montgomery County enjoys that luxury as well. So we have some great opportunities. We just have to implement them. Actually, I'm getting ready to have four individuals assigned to public education with my existing two, so we're actually increasing our staffing. Chief Dennis Rubin and Mayor Adrian Fenty believe in public education and educating our children more so and just not just only the school academics, but also in life safety. So we're really becoming engaged, but I told them we needed the resources to be able to do that. So it carries us to our next phase, which you're talking about, the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation and the 16 initiatives. Yeah, I talk about this quite often. I know the 16 life safety initiatives are in no particular order, but isn't it amazing that number 14 is public education and number 15 has to do with sprinklers? And I'm sure they weren't put that way specifically, but I think it's a trend that we've seen in the fire service that every major book a fire chief has on their desk, public education is at the back and usually the smallest chapter, and we're not included in ISO point value. We're not included in NIOSH firefighter fatality investigation reports. So I think the trend continues, and hopefully this group here today, as well as many others, we can make a stand. But I think in the fire station, what we have to educate our firefighters to understand is that their role, whether it's a certification or not, when you ask how many educators do you have in your department, it's not just one, it's not just two, it's everybody in the organization. And we have to get them to believe that. We talked earlier in a podcast about culture. That's a behavior change. I'm not a big fan of culture. To me, it's a behavior change. And with that particular behavior change, they have to understand that if we educate a family in a residential setting, that if they have a working smoke alarm and it goes off, they escape the home, practice their escape plan, go to their meeting place, have early activation of 911, the emergency services responds, they're at their meeting place, and tell us everybody's out of the house. without a doubt, that changes the tactical situation of a company officer and the crew arriving on scene. Their life safety is checked off on their checklist, and they can go into firefighting operations or suppression operations. But when we don't have that system in place, when we're not educating people to do just that, they're at a loss. They're already fighting the clock. They're fighting the unknown of whether people are in there, and we're already running into situations where flashover potentials are there. So public education can actually help firefighter safety, reduce line of duty deaths, reduce firefighter injuries on the job, and really it's the number one responsibility of the fire service.
You know, it's an amazing thing that you said, that the link between home escape plans and getting out, reporting to one place in the house or in the yard, and then when the fire department does get there, telling them that everybody's out. You recall that of course, the Prince William County, Virginia line of duty death could have been avoided had they known that nobody was in the house. They thought that time of the morning that somebody was there. Kyle Wilson, the firefighter from Prince William County, went in, was engulfed in a flashover, yeah. Lightweight construction. So it just unfortunate. And these are the kind of small things that we can do to improve or reduce the risk for firefighters. And we would certainly like them to understand that, so that they can see that everything they do in an outreach way may help in their survival at some point in time. So I appreciate that perspective.
Thank you, sir.
Excellent. Patsy Ann, not to be neglected here.
No, I'm
from
not
Alexandria,
feeling neglected.
Virginia. What kind of an impact has it had on the economy on you all? And, tell us a little bit about some of the programs going on.
Well, I'm very fortunate in Alexandria to have the support of a good fire chief, Adam Teal, but as Bill mentioned, some of our neighbors are not as fortunate. We've seen there's not really been a rise or a decrease in positions. However, the support of a budget to be able to rehire on-duty people to supplement our programs. We love having firefighters come to a school and sort of be a show and tell and have the kids visit the apparatus, but there's always that chance of them being pulled away, so it's really hard to get an education program in place. Our fire and life safety educators, who are certified to national standards, who want to implement programs on a regularly scheduled basis, there's one in Alexandria, that would be me, but there are also programs that, in fact, in the state of Virginia, and I will invite D.C. and Montgomery County and all our neighbors over, we have a program called Communicating with Children, which is a class that we teach to firefighters for recruit school. We haven't done that in Alexandria yet, but we hope to. And it is specifically how to teach firefighters how to communicate with children. They're amazing individuals, and they'll risk their lives to run into a burning building, but they're maybe scared to death to talk to a third grader about fire safety, and they're really fine. Once they get there, they're really fine. So we are very fortunate, but again, on the state level, we have had at least a half a dozen positions eliminated. So our plan is just to keep educating, just like the rest of the country is, without jobs and trying to go back to school. We, in the last year in Virginia, probably trained over 300 fire and life safety educators in fire and life safety educator one, which is an NFPA standard, juvenile fire setter intervention levels one and two. We've trained a significant amount in that area, and then over 500 firefighters have been trained. We're also trying to include in the group all public safety officials, police, sheriff, emergency management personnel, anyone who may be able to spread the word. When you're in front of an audience, it's the common audience that we all share. So you may as well reach in your briefcase and pull out whatever you can while you've got the captive audience, because as we have talked about, you don't get in there that often.
Excellent. Okay. Well, let me come back to you and ask you, do you really feel that anything has changed because of the economy, or do you really just you just have to find other ways to get it done? Is that what the case is?
Well, Mike, I think as educators, you're always, you know, in your mind, you're working smarter. You try to work smarter, not harder, but of course we all work very hard. I'd say we just continue to be creative and partner. If another public safety organization is going to an event and we can't make it, would you mind carrying some of our literature? We do that for one another in Alexandria. In terms of partnering throughout the state, we partner very much with the health department. Virginia has an injury and violence prevention coalition. They're the ones who partner with fire programs and the CDC to provide smoke alarm installation and education programs. And everybody has a little bit of something to offer. So, you know, we just have to be smarter and get the messages are the same. They're varied to different audiences, but the messages are the same. Our audience is the same. Again, we just have to communicate and, you know, it's no time for double work.
Excellent. And let me take off on what you said there, because I think it's a key thing. Partnerships and coalitions and all these things that that pull diverse groups of people together to get the word out. Billy, you mentioned ACORN. How did that relationship develop in Washington, D.C.?
Actually, they had contacted us to what they initially wanted was they were going to install the smoke alarms, and they wanted us to accompany, actually utilize our liability waiver form. And when I addressed that with them, I said that it would really be more feasible for us who go out on an everyday basis to install the smoke alarms. Let us do that. You go with us, because they had their own survey, and I believe they received their smoke alarms off a federal grant, and perhaps somebody here can define the acronym of what ACORN is. I can't name it right off the bat, so I apologize.
But it was certainly very famous in the election that we just had going on, and there was some concern about influence on people to get them out to vote. So and, ACORN kind of
and there's several branches of the overall umbrella. It's a citizen involvement, community involvement group. But what we did was just partner with them, so they were able to purchase the smoke alarms. And let me tell you, the smoke alarms they purchased were the top of the line. These weren't the cheap ones. These were voice-activated carbon monoxide and smoke alarm. You could program it to tell you exactly which part of the house the smoke alarm is in, what's going off, as well as fire extinguishers. So we formed a great partnership with them, and what we do is when we install the smoke alarm, the waiver we have, we give the information back to them. They follow up with the survey. So actually it went so successful, they were able to purchase more smoke alarms. So, you know, in the budget situation, what a great time to find a partner with them.
Excellent. And Dan, let me ask you what you have done as far as partnering with other groups in the community.
A lot of our partnerships involve the audiences that we need to talk to. We talked about earlier that we're short on public educators, even though every firefighter is an educator, those of us that are able to do it full time. So one of the things, and also for our programs, is reaching out to the adult audiences. If you're just talking to children, well, it's probably not going to have a big impact on fire prevention. So we're looking out to get more adults for two reasons. One, because the adults control fire prevention and safety in the home, but also, two, now we've got advocates out there in the community that will continue to spread the word. And two programs that we're working is one is in the colleges, and the other one involves continuing education units. And those of us in the fire service know what that is. In order to maintain your certification, you have to have so much education through the year. With the colleges, and just kind of describe one of the programs that's been most successful partnerships, is we teach a class in the health and safety education for students who are going on to be school teachers. And they take a class to learn how to teach health and safety education. So we go in there and we talk to them the importance of fire safety, having the firefighters involved in the school, but also important in terms of their medium between us and the home as well. So that was an important program. It's really paid off for us in the long run. A lot of the information that we teach in the class shows up in their final exams, and those teachers are now in the classrooms and are inviting us in and applying some of the things that it is that we're teaching. And not only just in terms of fire safety for the children, but how they react to fire safety in their classrooms. When the fire alarm goes off, that's not the time to tell the students to stay seated while you find out if it's a real fire alarm or not. You get the students out. And those little subliminal messages that the children pick up transfer back at home. And the other one, continuing education units, we've partnered up with the state and daycare providers and people who work in DSS are required to get so many continuing education units.
And what is DSS?
Department of Social Services.
Gotcha, okay.
Majority of our fires, as they are, I'm sure, across the United States, happen in low-income homes. So these are the folks that are working with these families, going into their homes and meeting with them on a regular basis. So they're required to maintain so many hours of training throughout the year to maintain their licenses and certifications, and they're strapped for money just like everybody else. So they can't afford to go across the state or to another state to receive that training. So we got approved through our state to award 3 hours of continuing education units on fire safety. So not only do we teach them about home fire safety, but also when they go into these homes where we're having our fires, that they know to look for smoke detectors, they know to check the family if they have a fire escape plan. Is it a viable fire escape plan? Do they have a fire extinguisher? Is it mounted or is it under the kitchen sink? And things like that. So now we have a lot of advocates out there that are reaching more people than just the fire department in itself. So that's some of the unique partnerships that we have.
That's excellent. As we sit here and talk, you have all these little things that can go off in many different directions because there's so many good things to talk about. But one of the things you mentioned was others' eyes and ears and actions that can help us. It expands our scope of influence in fire and life safety. And one of the things that comes about as a challenge in that is convincing some of these groups that they're not going to be in trouble if something happens necessarily, but that's a fear that they have of going out there and making recommendations or putting in smoke alarms. What is the liability? That's one of the barriers we've had to getting other groups and partners involved in some things. And I'm certain that there's some best practices out there that we can use and talk about nationally that others have solved this problem of convincing people that it's really not as high a liability as you may think, and you probably already know some of the basics about this evaluating somebody's home. If they don't have a smoke alarm, by golly, we got to get one in there, and really there's no time like the present right now to get it in there because anything can happen in the next few minutes or hours. Any experience, anybody would like to raise their hand for a second and let me know if they can talk to that issue?
I'd like to follow up on the issue Lieutenant brought up. When we talk about going out into the public, and I want to go back to firefighter safety for just a moment with this, is to make sure that the firefighters who are out there listening today, that when we talk about public safety education, that we're not specifically talking about standing in front of a group of children. That we know engine companies go to fast food restaurants, they go to the grocery stores, they go to commercial occupancies. Simple enough going to a grocery store and seeing shopping carts blocking a fire exit or debris or boxes blocking a fire exit. That's an education moment. And we know that certain individuals are tailored to work with children, other individuals are tailored to work with adults. And I think that's a great opportunity for firefighters to understand that if they can make a difference in a commercial setting where we tend to see less fire deaths, we can continue that trend. True, there's an enforcement piece there that really helps out, but when the inspector only goes out every twice a year or maybe once a year, that void in between, that's when firefighters, their eyes and ears can become educators without thinking you got to sit in front of a room full of kids. So I heard that mentioned before about going out into the public and making a difference, and I wanted to really talk about that to highlight firefighter safety again.
Thank you for that. Now, we just received word on what the acronym ACORN stands for, and Billy, maybe you could just...
Yeah, as my co-host here. We're rapidly looking through their Blackberries. I do apologize to all my Acorn friends who've given us grants. Association of Community Organization for Reform Now. So thank you so much for what you do, and thanks to my partners for being our resources here in the,
and of
in
course
the podcast.
Of course, the word community is prevalent in that word. So obviously, their mission is to help in the community. And Billy, you mentioned about, or maybe it was Dan. I'm sorry if I lost track. But the high propensity, especially for African Americans to have fire deaths. This is in data throughout the country, and it's something that we've got to figure out how to solve that problem. Let me bring Teresa Neal into the conversation for a second here, and I'm going to hand her the mic in just a second, because we were talking about partnerships, and I did want her to tell a story from Central Virginia, Harrisonburg. Wanda Willis, who does the public education, wasn't able to be here today, but I think it's a really interesting story, and it talks about, you know, creativity and how to get into homes, and it does involve a partnership. So, Teresa, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you're related to this area of fire and life safety.
Okay, I'm Teresa Neal. I'm a fire program specialist at the United States Fire Association. So I have I work in public education and prevention, so that's how I've been able to make contact with different people that go out and actually teach the public prevention methods or in schools teaching children about prevention.
And of course, U.S. Fire Administration had the parade conference, which is the group of state fire marshals and metro size fire department fire marshals throughout the country meet every year and a half, every 2 years to network and talk about fire prevention problems. And it was one of the representatives from Harrisonburg, Virginia, was Wanda Willis, and she's a lieutenant down there, and told us a story. Would you like to talk about that?
Right, that's where I met Wanda Willis, also was at the parade conference. But she talked about a pizza program that they did. And the fire department went and talked to a pizza company, a delivery company that does not normally deliver, which was, for them, it was CC's Pizza. And they, for 4 hours, people could call in and order pizzas. And during that time, after the pizza was ordered, they went and delivered the pizza in a fire truck. And by ordering this pizza and getting it, you were allowing the fire department to come in and check your smoke alarms to see if you had a smoke alarm and if you had a working smoke alarm. So she said in those 4 hours, they distributed 445. They were able to go to 445 different homes and be able to check for smoke alarms and that they had batteries. I don't have the specific numbers, but they did actually give out fire alarms, and then they also changed batteries and some that just weren't working. So she said that was a real opportunity to actually get into the homes and have the firefighters talking with the families. And the smoke alarms were from the Virginia grant that
Get Alarm Virginia.
But the pizzas, their chief, Chief Shiflett, Larry Shiflett, he actually, in their budgeted for those. He felt that it was so important to be able to get the firefighters into the homes that he made that a line item in their budget. And they paid for the pizzas that people called in.
Very good. That is a very interesting story. And it just shows, you know, some of the different things that you can do. And I really think that it's unlimited, the involvement. The interesting thing about Harrisonburg, Virginia, is that it is the home for James Madison University. And, of course, school towns have their own sets of problems in regard to fire safety. And, of course, we have the Campus Fire Safety Watch and all of the other good things that have come about in recent years to try to reduce the risk to college students, both off-base campus and on campus housing. It's a tragedy to be in an institution and be at risk A lot of it's behavior, a lot of it's not as good a management as it could be. But let me revert over to Bill Delaney now and talk about a different kind of partnership that you were involved in. And that was, you mentioned earlier about the high risk that we were starting to notice in Montgomery County with senior citizens. And at that time, Chief Tom Carr, fire chief, and the county executive had formed a task force. Do you want to talk a little bit? That's a different kind of partnership of involving community members in solving the problem. Talk a little bit about the Senior Citizen Fire Safety Task Force.
Yeah, it was great because I think, again, there's an underlying theme here now of partnerships, which I think is the right thing to do, especially in these times. But we really brought together the entire community, literally, and from every walk of life. And, of course, we did have a couple folks who were very well known. Hal Bruno, for one, was a part of this group. But we brought together people from our alcohol control.
Yeah.
And I don't remember
Montgomery County,
name.
By the way, controls the liquor sales in Montgomery County, and they have their own warehouse stores, and they also do a lot of public education in relation to substance abuse. But
We brought in them, people from the Burn Center, Consumer Affairs. We brought in a representative from the building industry, specifically apartment building industry, and every walk of life, and a public educator from the Health and Human Services that dealt with drug addiction and stuff. And the interesting thing was they all brought a different perspective to the table. And, for example, now I look at a lot of when we had a lot of our elderly deaths were quote-unquote smoking-related fire deaths. But as we actually looked at the statistics and looked at what was going on, I would argue they were actually drug-related deaths. And not to say that these seniors are taking illegal drugs. They were over-medicating. And just the medications they were on were causing them to become drowsy. We did have some that had some alcohol in their system and such. And it was just neat to get that whole different perspective. So we really used an entire community to bring different perspectives, different angles. And now we've come up with a solution that not just from a strictly, okay, all these people died of smoking-related fires, use the right ashtray, blah, blah, blah. But we started talking about addiction to drugs, alcohol impacts, and everything else associated with seniors that might impact them and their decision-making or their lack of decision-making, and bringing in the caregivers. We brought in a caregiver group. And it was from every realm, every spectrum that you can think of. And I know I'm even forgetting a couple of groups that were involved in that. But really bringing everyone to the table to solve a community problem. And we've been able to implement a lot of that stuff. The only big thing we haven't was we did get a position out of it. We were supposed to get a position, and that was our budget casualty so far. But I know until recently, our senior deaths have actually started to go down because we're even partnering with the mental health folks. And not just Meals on Wheels, but there's people go into folks that are having mental health issues. There are folks that just go in just to visit for various other types of programs within Health and Human Services, and gets back to that eyes and ears thing you were referring to earlier with the pizza program and some of the other programs that have already been mentioned.
Good, thank you. And the one thing that I think that is the beauty of formally forming a group, especially when you involve people in the community who have a stake in this, but also an interest, but also you have the opportunity. In this case, it took 2 years to go through, and we did an interim report and a final report with specific recommendations from a body of people who became very passionate about this. Bill had mentioned Hal Bruno, who's written for many years in Firehouse Magazine, was just intrigued by the whole social endeavor. They all became friends and became committed, not only experts, but committed, passionate, involved people in the fire problem in Montgomery County, Maryland. And I think that's some of the things that you don't know. We look to solve the problem by writing a document, but what we got was far more.
And yeah, as a matter of fact, if I could just interject, I mean, I was the one who sort of got it started, but I was even skeptical. I just thought, well, you know, we have our fire reps, we'll kind of guide them, and, you know, we'll just do what the heck we think we know we should be doing. And boy, was I wrong. And I came away totally convinced that when you want to start solving some sort of a fire problem in your community, there's a lot of folks you really need to get involved from the community. I learned a lot from that experience, a tremendous amount. And like I said, I went in with the attitude, we're the fire service. We know what the heck we're doing. We'll just guide them to what we want. And I'm glad it didn't go that way.
Well, let's take this now in a little bit of a different direction and talk about some programs that you have in your areas. I know we've touched on some, but maybe you can focus on one particular thing that you think is pretty innovative or one that you can show some success at. Billy, why don't you talk, you know, maybe about a focus that you've had as far as a program.
One that I want to talk about is one that we would like to establish in the District of Columbia. Prior to coming to D.C., I was a fire chief for the city of Riverdale, Georgia, for about 8 years down in Clayton County, which is metropolitan Atlanta. We started a program called Citizens Fire Academy. I know there's Citizen Corps and several other programs out there, but we called this Citizens Fire Academy. And over a 10-week period, one night a week for 2 hours a night, we did it every Tuesday night, we had about 20 people from our community come in, and we taught them about the fire service. We taught them the history of the fire service, what it truly means to be in the fire service. We taught them about their organization, and I say their organization because the fire service truly belongs to the community and not just to us, and I think that's a frame of mind we have to change, that it is their fire department. And then we also teach them about the different things that we go through and let them experience some of what we encounter as emergency responders. But we spent two weeks on fire prevention because we felt that was the key to where we could really reach out to them. So we took it one step further. I got tired of seeing neighborhood watch signs all over my community. So what we did was went to Public Works. We had signs created, said neighborhood fire marshal on watch. And we put that up. If we had a graduate of our program that lived in a specific neighborhood, we put the sign at the entrance of the neighborhood. Part of their training through our Citizens Fire Academy, they learned how to install smoke alarms. They were very proficient in that. They also got out with their neighbors, so it encouraged community involvement in the neighborhood. But also they conducted neighborhood fire drills. So there was a certain time of the month that they would have a neighborhood fire drill. And they would all get out there. They'd have a street party. So it really blossomed into something that just was a focus of, quite honestly, I got tired of seeing law enforcement get all the credit for the good stuff that they were doing when we were doing things just as good. So we went after that. And believe it or not, when our first class graduated, they actually came to a council meeting and presented us with a huge plaque. They presented us with a poem, you know, all kind of crazy stuff. And we were teeter-tottering on whether our budget was going to pass. And actually, because of that, I was able to get another educator position funded. So not only was it good for the community, it turned out to be good for us in our endeavors, but that was a program that we did in Riverdale, and I certainly want to try to do that in the District of Columbia, much larger project, but I'm up for it. So,
excellent. That is interesting. And of course, I think that this whole process of fire and life safety has to be provided in some way so that people take responsibility for it themselves, as opposed to us being, you know, the deliverer, the only people that can say you need to be more fire safe. It's not working. They have to accept it, embrace it, and spread the word themselves as well.
Chief, if we look at our media, which seems to be the main form of communication for our public, and when the pandemic scare or the bird flu scare, one or two people in the millions upon millions of people who live in this country, it becomes a national media event. But every year we lose between 3,000 and 4,000 people continuously, and there's no outcry. There's no public outcry. This is a national epidemic, and there's no media focus on that. That's something that's got to change, and I'm sure U.S. Fire Administration is taking notes, and our new U.S. Fire Administrator will step in and carry on the mission of the past. So.
Well, it's we're in a transition, and it'll be interesting to see how all this goes. They're going to have to create a whole new organization, and I'm sure we anticipate all that. Let me take a break here just for a second.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Alert All has been featured as the leader in fire prevention on both the International Fire Chiefs Association TV and the Economic Report with Greg Gumbel. Since 2001, Alert All has offered free ground shipping on fire prevention orders. This has resulted in a savings of more than $2.7 million to our fire prevention customers. We believe that money is better spent on products that further fire safety and prevention education, not on shipping charges. Alert All will continue to develop new and innovative products each year that offer the best quality material at the best value to our customers. If through our combined efforts even one life can be saved, then we truly have been successful. For free information and samples, please call 1-800-253-7825 or visit www.alertall.com.
I'm going to move to Dan Byrne again and talk about programs that he may be proud of that he liked to talk about.
Well, I'm naturally proud of all my programs. They have to be unique. If you look at the statistics, since the America Burning Report in the 70s, fires had a steep decline until about the mid-90s, and it planed out. And if you look now more recently, they're actually on the rise. So we've got to come with another approach to fire safety. And I already mentioned one of them that we're very, very proud of is reaching out to the adults. And like you mentioned, we're going beyond just fire safety. We talked to building codes and construction classes. These are guys that are going out and building these homes on the importance of following the codes of residential sprinkler systems, of advocating. And I am amazed that people that are in the contracting field still believe the myths of one go off, they all go off, and they make your insurance go up. So we're educating on that as well. Everything from how to build a building to also the reason why we need to have turnaround. We need to have access to the building. So they're seeing fire in a totally different aspect to support the fire service, more than just fire safety, fire safety, fire safety. And I'd like to think that in my community, and as reflected in the city council's three priorities, that they see fire prevention and education as not just something that comes around once a year, but synonymous with quality of life all year long. So reaching out to the adults, we're very proud of. Another program that we have that's pretty unique, and it's now that I'm seeing these children from the daycare ages and they're getting in the elementary schools, a lot of the programs that have a trial by error. You seem to work, and then wow, you realize a couple years later, hey, that really did work. Daycare is a very particular and peculiar age to reach out to because their learning is at different levels, and you can actually do harm. The very first time when I first started doing education, I learned this lesson. We brought some daycare children into our safety house, and they were naturally more concerned with the house than they were with what I was saying. One child started crying, set off an epidemic, and the children wound up leaving the safety house. When I went to the class, about a week later, they were still nervous around me. So you can do a lot of damage. So we created a program to reach them because children under the age of 5 are more likely, twice as likely to die in a house fire. So you have to reach that age group. And we call it our First Impressions program. It's a 4-day program, 30 minutes a day, real quick. When we start off, we just introduce firefighters in a friendly way, read books to them, we make fire engine noises, and then we just slowly introduce fire safety. The next day, we do tools and toys, where we bring in, and all the tools are in their safe packages, but hammers and things like that, so children identify tools that will do them harm, and they go into a toolbox, you bring a toolbox in there, toys go in the toy box, and we play with the toys, and then that's how we introduce matches and lighters. They're tools just like the saw that goes in the toolbox for mom and dad. And the third day, we do stop, drop, and roll. Now, this is something that I learned also, that children can sing a very neat song about stop, drop, and roll, but they actually cannot get down and perform the skill, which is amazing. Their motor skills and aren't quite there yet. So we have a mat where they put Velcro flames on them, and they have to roll until all the flames come off. And then on the last day, we do the friendly firefighter. We bring the firefighter in, we dress them out from uniform all the way up to full bunker gear. The children get a chance to touch the gear. We play the Where Are You game, and once the children feel comfortable, we line them up on a line, and the firefighter crawls and says, Where are you, through his SCBA, and the children have to say, Here I am. So he touches each one of their feet, and every day they take home a flyer to the mom and dad. It's in different color paper, because if you remember, when you have children, you get a stack of paper, you discard the ones except for the ones that have a color to it, because, well, that might be important, I might want to look at this. But we tell mom and dad, this is what we did with your children, this is what you should do as well at home, and there's also firefighter homework. And every day, the first day, mom and dad have to show the child where the meeting places. And then the second day that mom and dad have to show the children all the smoke detectors so they can hear it. And then the third day they actually have to do a home fire drill and mom and dad have to sign it. And when the children bring it back the next day, at the end of every day, and this is, you know, fire departments put a lot of money into plastic fire hats and all these things, and then just hand them out, you know, and they go in the trash. They really don't do anything for the child at 2 o'clock in the morning when there's a real fire. But in order for the children to receive that, they have to perform the skill and go through the program. So, I'm starting to see these children in first grade, second grade, now coming up to third grade, and they remember the lessons that we taught back in the kindergarten. And when we walk in the class, it's not, oh, here's the firefighter's going to talk to us about fire safety, but they're excited because they know it's going to be fun and it's going to be dynamic. So it's been a relationship from the daycares all the way up to the senior citizens and the whole package in between.
Oh, excellent. I mean, that, you know, how do you reach any particular group? But that group in particular, we talked about the seniors. So there are two different ends of the spectrum that we, you know, worried about here, and now we're going to worry about them again when they get to that other age. There's a huge group in between as well who has influences on both these groups. So what a complicated issue, and we got our work cut out for us, don't we?
We do.
But let me then move to Patsy, and then what I do want to do is bring Sandy Fasanoli up from U.S. Fire Administration to talk about some available federal programs and some new initiatives there. But Patsy Ann, let's talk about Alexandria and maybe a program that you cherish there.
Well, we were talking about, well, I would like to say, I believe it was Billy who mentioned the importance of everyone learning to take care of themselves. As educators, we really need to empower individuals with education, because then in turn they're going to want to go help their neighbor a little more, they're feel a little more confident, they're going to take CPR, etc., join the medical corps. So in Alexandria, we have a very active CERT program, Community Emergency Response Team, for those who are listening. And this is a free program to the citizens of Alexandria. They come for eight weeks, one night, one evening a week, and they learn basic, you know, several different topics, such as basic first aid, how to operate a smoke alarm, I'm sorry, how to operate a fire extinguisher, search and rescue, even the psychology of what happens after a fire or someone's been through a tragedy. So it touches on a little bit. It's a similar program that the Red Cross would use to prepare disaster volunteers. And then at the end, they have a graduation, and that's been supported for quite some time. I guess after September 11th, of course, there was a more resurgence in the Citizen Corps program. So that's very active and going strong in Alexandria.
Let me mention real quick, Citizen Corps, of course, is a program that was started after 2011 or 2001, the 9/11 attacks, and has become, I think, a proven program. We have used as well CERT people to do different kinds of work to help with evacuation of high rises for drills, and Bill was involved with some of those kind of things, but also trying to get fire corps programs started where you we talked about college campuses, you know, students that can be involved in that is an area that's probably we've barely scratched the surface. And so your program, then, you use these volunteers who are well trained and are intensely interested in these programs to go out and deliver services, correct?
They help with special events. They provide extra staffing. In the past, they've also been trained to install smoke alarms, as we talked about. Once they get over that feeling of, you know, I'm not qualified, or maybe I'll do it the wrong way, but at the end of the day, you know, any resident can install their own smoke alarm. They just need a little confidence. And, you know, our backup is we go by the instructions that are in the box that, you know, we're helping you install the smoke alarm. If there's a failure on any part, you know, which we hope there wouldn't be, but it's, you know, it's the manufacturer's responsibility. But, yes, our CERT members do things like that. And, yeah, they're an invaluable resource.
Well, and especially we opened the show up here with the discussion of the economy and resources and all the other things that come with struggling to try to get this job done. And And these are actually citizens that may not be interested in the fire industry, but want to help out. Fire Corps in itself has taken off, and they've done research into how to recruit volunteers, and they have a whole comprehensive range of how to get this program going. And that you certainly can find, I believe.
I'm sure there's a link off of the USFA website to Fire Corps.
Okay, and believe me, that is a valuable resource. Let me turn now, as a nice segue, to Sandy. Sandy, why don't you tell us a little bit about your role and, you know, when you came to the U.S. Fire Administration and some of the other programs that you wanted to talk about.
Okay, I am Sandy Fasinoli. I'm Chief of Prevention and Information, part of the National Fire Programs at USFA in Emmitsburg, Maryland. I am new, been here several months, and enjoying and learning so much every single day. But it's a perfect segue here, Mike, to talk a little bit about a new resource that we're that is up on our website. We're calling it the Fire Prevention and Public Education Exchange. And all these wonderful programs that we're hearing about today, we know that it's really hard to remember who the heck is Dan, who the heck is Bill or Bill, and where are we going to find these things. And so we are building off of our Learning Resource Center, which has a catalog online, and I'm going to give you the URL here in just a minute. You can search for fire prevention education programs, and these are things that may not have a book or associated with it or a toolkit or something. It may be a website. It may be a handout. It may be a description of that we've put together in working with the program manager and describing what the program is. So that if you've heard something today that you're interested in, we're certainly going to follow up and make sure all these things are part of our exchange. But we're working across the country in identifying good programs that may be best kept secrets down in South Carolina or wherever they are, so that we can make them available to all of our colleagues and members of the community to use these materials. And so right now, if you want to get to it, if you couldn't wait to find out more about it, it's www.lrc.fema.gov/exchange.html. And it is part of our Learning Resource Center, which is off of our USFA website. And it's just starting. You're in on the ground floor here, but we're working hard to reach out as far as we can to take note of all good programs that are out there. We have a template that if you're listening and say, I'd like my program to be part of that, or my material, or my website to be a part of that, we have a little template that you can fill out. We'll take a look at it, make sure that it's legitimate and valuable and can contribute to the effort to reduce fire loss in our country, and we'll be working with you individually. Teresa Neal, who you heard from just a few minutes ago, is leading this effort for us. And Teresa, I'm going to give them your email address. It's teresa.neal, teresa.neal@dhs.gov. And so if you'd like to know more about it, she'll be happy to chat with you about that.
Excellent. And, of course, we have later on this year, I believe we're coming up on the 35th anniversary of the U.S. Fire Administration, and that'll be noted in the fall. And so hope everybody has an opportunity to pay attention to some of the activities around that and reflect. Also, I want to mention, and these are all things that are related to the U.S. Fire Administration, of course, the U.S. Fire Administration's website does have just a tremendous amount of resources that are probably untapped, let alone the LRC, which is a bank of information in its own right. So thank you, Sandy, for talking about
this. Delighted to be here today. Thank you.
Anything else you want to talk about?
Nope. Just be sure to visit our website, get in contact with Teresa Neal so that we can make sure that your programs are part of our exchange. Or if you just want to know more about it, we're happy to do that. We just feel like this is something that an awful lot of our colleagues have talked about. One-stop shopping. Where can we can find out about all this cool stuff? And we're just glad to help start that right now, and we're building it. And so we'd like your suggestions and ideas as well. So
excellent. We're you know, we, like I said before, we still have a lot to do, and we cannot tolerate 3,000 fire deaths in a year in homes, and you know, we just, you know, a lot of it is, you know, ones and twos all over the place, and they don't make big news. And when you add them all up, it's a significant problem. It's a health issue. It's a endemic in its own right. But let's move on to some other areas. And we've talked a lot about around the fringes about school, grade school, and we certainly have talked about college as well. But one of the things that I just throw out there, of course, that some public educators will talk about, is that schools now, of course, are held under some pretty high pressure to ensure that grades and test scores are achieving at a high level, so that we can continue to, you know, compete in the world, as well as you know, make sure that the United States has relevant and capable workers. Well, you know, No Child Left Behind was focused on trying to make sure that populations that may not have normally done as well are focused on. So it kind of spread out a lot of the resources in the school system, and time is really constrained in schools now. A lengthy lead up to this, but what kind of things have you all dealt with in regard to being able to still get into schools and be able to provide programs? Dan, why don't you talk about any of your school experiences that might be relevant to this subject?
Well, that was a huge challenge. The teachers would tell me when I first started, you know, we think fire safety is important, but if I don't get my children's math score up, I'm going to lose my job. So I'm going to teach what's prevalent. You have to be unique and creative. For example, the schools, what are the teachers trying to teach? What subjects are they trying to get their children to learn? And how can you tie fire safety into it? And if you're creative, you can do that. If it's a history class, well, I can come in and talk about Benjamin Franklin. And by the way, Benjamin Franklin was a volunteer firefighter, and the ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure is actually a fire safety message that he created. If it's a science class, obviously, fire can fit into a science class, conduction, radiation, convection. But find out what the teacher is, what her objectives are, his objectives are, and how you can tie fire safety into it. And not only is that going to get you into school, but you're continuously in the school. The children don't see you one time a year, they see you all year long. We also have a reading program where we go and read to the children. We don't start or finish a book unless we talk about fire safety or do something safety related. And if you're creative, you can tie reading into fire safety. Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall because he never heard a smoke detector before. Little Bo Peep lost her sheep because they never did a fire drill before. So if you're creative, you can continuously be in the schools, and the teachers appreciate it, and they see that partnership, and they wind up utilizing you much, much more. We also have a school lunch program where every Friday we go into the schools and sit and have lunch with the children. Some of the firefighters now go out in the schoolyard and they play kickball, basketball. I even have a picture of them, a couple of them playing jump rope that I'm keeping for a rainy day. But they're in the schools, and that's also important as well, because if you're going to receive a message from somebody, what is a child going to get a message take more to heart, from another adult that's coming and telling what he can and can't do, or from somebody she identifies as a friend? So those, you have to be unique. You have to figure out what they want and partner up with the schools. And this is also very important too, because the schools that are coming to visit you during fire prevention time and have the money to do that are probably not the schools in the neighborhood that you're having fires in. The best way to put it is, don't be lazy. Figure out where your fire problems are, where the children that are in those neighborhoods, where they're going to school, and get in those schools. A lot of fire departments sit back and they get the tours and they get the schools that are coming to them, but those aren't the ones that are having the problem. So get creative, figure out where your fire problem is, and find ways to get in the school. It might not happen the first time. They might say, well, no thanks, but keep going, keep being persistent. In my state as well, it's mandated that health and safety education is taught to every student, and in health and safety education is fire prevention. And those in my state responsible for teaching that are the PE teachers. So when I approach them about teaching fire safety, they're just more than ecstatic to give me a whole week in every class. So now they've got a week off, they don't have to teach, but yet they are meeting their objective of health and safety education. So there, it's just that type of a partnership. You really have to be creative. If you're just trying to get in there during 1 week out of the year just to talk fire safety the standard way we've always done it, you're probably going to get a lot of closed doors, or, okay, you've got 2 minutes to talk and that's it, and you have to get out while I teach this other class. So creativity.
Oh, that's that's really a good example of how to integrate the educational message in there. And interestingly enough, there was a program that the Home Safety Council did with the Literacy Council to interject a fire safety message in literacy training, which was, of course, most of it was adults, and teaching reading to an adult who couldn't read or write using fire safety messages. So it kind of goes along with what you're saying, and that's another whole group that we need to be able to get to, and there are a lot more people out there with literacy deficit than we realize. So, Patsy Ann, let me jump in your direction here and see what you might like to talk about in regard to school relationships.
Well, I think all of us around this table and in the audience are familiar with NFPA, that's National Fire Protection Association's Risk Watch program, which is fire and life safety. And just to define life safety a little more, not only fire prevention, but burn prevention, water safety, poison prevention, child passenger safety, bicycle helmets, etc. The Risk Watch program meticulously, they have a matrix of correlated topics with the state SOLs. And it's kind
of... And what is SOLs, Patsy?
Standards of Learning.
There we go, thank you.
Standards of Learning. And it's kind of a no-brainer for, an educator to have this new, fresh curriculum. The challenge is still for school educators to still make time for that. And as part of our state coalition, the Virginia Fire and Life Safety Education Coalition that I'm a member of, we are working closely with our state decision makers to try to reemphasize that and make sure when they update their standards of learning every year that the fire and life safety components are still in there somewhere. We're also explaining to them and emphasizing the value of all hazards education, which would include disaster preparedness.
Excellent, thank you. And let me mention Billy has talked about some of the work they've already done in public schools in Washington, D.C. And of course, interestingly, they've had a very high profile effort in the city to kind of get back into the more intensive education. And Michelle Ree, who is a very interesting, unique superintendent of schools, how is that related? How has that worked out for you all? Because they're really trying to get a culture change there.
They are. She's doing a wonderful job as the chancellor, and with Chief Rubin at his level, communicating with her and the importance of it. I agree with Dan saying that you've got to be creative and work with the teachers and show them the product you have to offer fits into what they're trying to accomplish. Because he's exactly right. They have a job to do, and they're held to their standards. But working with the administration, getting the support from up above, it's just like working in a fire department. You can't expect policies to be enforced down at the company level if they're not supported up top at the executive level. So the same thing, we're working diligently to get our upper echelon involved. Actually, I have a meeting next week with the curriculum designer of the safety and health section because they're in their pre-planning period. I've been working with the PE teachers where a lot of the health and safety area goes to, so we've focused on them, but we're meeting to re-implement again next week because they understand the difficulties we have. Even though we've gone out and trained the teachers, getting that implemented in the classroom at that level has been a little bit more difficult. So fortunately, they're open to that, and I'll be out there with them, and we hope to make a significant change because we've had a lot of children who've been lost this year in fires, as well as seniors. We've been all over the scale between electrical, cooking, senior, young, trying to find a trend out of this year's fire fatalities. It's just, I think the only trend you can find is anybody and everybody is going to be a victim.
Right. I agree. And of course, we deal with these phases that we go through. And this past week, it just seems like every fire that we've had come in have been related to electrical fires, overloaded power strips, and we have, you know, eight people living in a one-bedroom apartment, and you know, so all these things are the challenges that we have, and it really is a very unique and challenging area that that's very interesting. But we, again, like I said before, we have a lot of work to do. Let me switch gears now and talk about Fire Prevention Week, which is certainly coming up in October, and it's generally the anniversary of the Great Chicago Fire. And I would also, at this point in time, a point for folks to ponder out there, one of the leading fatality fires that occurred in this country's history occurred the same day as the Great Chicago Fire. So I'll certainly ask people out there in the podcast land to try to think of what that fire was. It was all right up there in the same area of Chicago. So maybe we'll give that away at the end of the podcast. But Bill, talk about what your thoughts are about how to approach Fire Prevention Week from an outreach standpoint. I've always, yes, it's a good time to focus on the year, but I tend to kind of play it down as the only role that you can play as far as outreach and fire prevention, but it certainly is an opportunity nationally for a focus to be able to be played on fire safety. So,
well, and we're unique too in that we're a combination department, as you're well aware, and we try to partner with our local volunteer departments, you know, get some signage on the stations identifying it, because again, you know, our approach is it should be every day of the year, but it is a great opportunity, and they do a lot of open houses, so we provide as much support as they want with some of the stuff we have, like a hazard house and some other educational tools. You know, and Dan mentioned it earlier where, yeah, we have some giveaways, but we always try to make sure that the kids are doing something, you know, answering a question or maybe did a home escape plan, depending on the age of the child, you know, to earn it rather than just throw it out there. So, you know, we work with them a lot, and they do a really good job of getting the open house going and connecting with their communities. And of course, we try to get in, you know, through our school programs to do some things there with our we have a great person who manages our school outreach programs, and really just throwing out hitting them too on the internet with the stuff we do with blog talk radio shows and some YouTube things, which is all free resources, by the way, for people out there. It doesn't cost you a dime. So just to kind of hit that message, that target group that Chief you mentioned earlier, that we're not hitting that 18 to 50-something group, you know, we kind of say bye to the kids after elementary school and say, see you when you're a senior. So I spent a lot of time doing some outreach there to that group.
Okay, thank you for that. And of course, you know, you bring up an interesting point. And unfortunately, I think sometimes the focus on Fire Prevention Week becomes more of the not the education factor, but the entertainment
right.
factor. And of course, we've had some criticism nationally about how grants have been dispersed, and that the grants oftentimes have purchased things that are more of entertainment value. And I use this word edutainment that people have used in the past, but maybe we can also discuss, as far as grants go, how you can focus on maybe integrating that entertainment hook with the opportunity then to educate somebody. And of course, you mentioned, and Dan mentioned as well, about ensuring that there's some participation that values an increase in fire safety knowledge. But Dan, maybe you could talk to some of those issues about, you know, Fire Prevention Week and the entertainment factor that oftentimes people are just looking for something to do And this is just seems to be the time of the year when we're having this event. So, hey, let's go to the fire station and see how we can be entertained.
Exactly. And there's a big difference between educating and training. If you're using entertainment tools as a mean to draw audiences to your fire station, that's great. But you've really got to make sure if you're using characters like Sparky or SpongeBob SquarePants or you're doing puppet shows, in order to use those effectively to educate, you really need to understand how to use those effectively to, in fact, educate. And one thing about Fire Prevention Week that I think needs to be brought up, it's not just about preventing fires. We're here talking about firefighter safety, so it's not just about preventing fires or saving the lives of our citizens, but this is a week for us to save the lives of our own. Less fires mean less responses, means there's less risk that our firefighters are being put up against. Majority of the firefighters will die in residential structures beyond where codes. It's all about education. So for a fire department to get set up for Fire Prevention Week this time coming around, make it real easy. Come up with the top two problems that you have in your community, the top two fire problems. You want to educate about everything, but keep it narrow. The top two fire problems that you have, look at it from a three-dimensional approach. How do you prevent it? If it happens, how do you react to it? And if it gets out of control, how do you survive it? And then design your program around it cognitively. Get them up and demonstrating. The environment that they are in if they're trapped inside a house fire is the exact same environment that we go crawling into to pull them out. And nobody here at this table learned how to be a firefighter because we watched a video, we were entertained, we sang a song, we got a plastic fire hat, and we were put on the fire truck, go put out fires now. We actually had to train. So while you might use those entertaining things to make it interesting, because if it's dry and it's boring, people aren't going to come, they're going to tune you out. So it has to have a little bit of that, but the skills, you have to get them up and demonstrating. Your education has to be cognitive. And if you're at a loss for programs, talk to your training officer. Take a firefighter survival training class, adapt it to a civilian mode, and have them do that. They seem to enjoy actually using a fire extinguisher to put out a fire. They seem to enjoy crawling around. We use our safety house and we smoke it up, and the adults enjoy it, the children enjoy it, and it's entertaining, but they're actually practicing and utilizing those skills. So I think if you take a look at that and start planning now, look at the neighborhoods we're having fires, think of how you can get in there and approach it from three-dimensional and come up with programs that get them up demonstrating it. You're going to get the most out of it at the end of the week, not only for our citizens, your community, but also for the guys in your fire station and the girls in your fire station. You never know when that fire would have happened that could have had a drastic result for everybody because you prevented it.
Well, I think that's excellent advice, and I think that especially from the U.S. Fire Administration's programs in delivering fire education programs, they talk about the need to focus on, you know, priorities and risk problems and not get too broad, not too scattered with your message and work at that for, you know, several years in these focus areas before you can really see some efforts or some good outcomes to your efforts.
Chief,
thank you for that.
Before we step away from what Dan said, because I think he hit on a point that I was getting ready to say, and maybe we could wrap that piece of it up, is exactly what he's talking about, firefighter safety. Not only is it Fire Prevention Week, but it's also the National Fallen Firefighter Memorial Weekend. And we have to pay respect to the men and women who've given the ultimate sacrifice, whether it's responding to, operating at, or returning from an incident, specifically a structure fire that could have been prevented. And I think we owe it to those and to their families to reinforce the message to the public that they have an obligation, that they have a responsibility. And we tend to just kind of let things go in the U.S., and if you burn your house down, insurance is going to pay for it. We're going to send the Red Cross out to take care of you, and the community is going to feel sorry for you. We got to take a step beyond that. We got to start holding people accountable, because we lose men and women every year because something could have been prevented. And I think that's a great time, and I wanted to really piggyback on that while Dan had brought it up, because it is truly about firefighter safety.
And I think the fire service, and I'm going to jump on that one too, we lose an average of 100 firefighters in a line of duty every year. And out of 1.1 million firefighters, that's less than 1% of our profession will lose their life every year. And we as a fire service have determined that, well, that's too much. We're going to throw everything that we have in these conferences, the training, the curriculum, the money, the grants, everything we've got to reduce that number, because 100 is just too much. And I agree. Firefighter safety, if 8 hours of training will save the life of one, well, let's double it. Let's do 16 next time. But we lose 3,000 to 4,000 civilians in fires every year. The very people that we put this uniform on and said that we're going to protect, that coincidentally our firefighters are dying, responding to, operating at, and returning from. So if we put as much effort in the fire service to preventing these fires that we do to prevent the loss of our firefighters, we might actually see a reduction in both. Right now we're putting all our money and effort into a revolving circle, a sinking hole. It's all reactive, because once they show up in the fire scene, they're automatically at risk. So if you can reduce that risk at the beginning, then we can make a difference.
Great point.
Okay, thank you. And I appreciate that. I'd love to see the integration of that message of firefighter safety and survival and the whole fire problem and fire and life safety education and prevention, because I think it's so tied together that you can't separate it. And I think that the Fallen Firefighters Foundation and the initiatives that were developed really do, despite the fact that it is lower in the numbers, does identify that. And I think that we need to really promote that even more. Patsy Ann, talk to us about some of the things that you do during Fire Prevention Week. You have a different, because it is a city, an older city, which certainly has a draw for the historic areas. And does that have anything to do with Fire Prevention Week that you noticed? There was a very old history of fire protection in the city of Alexandria. Any thoughts on that?
Well,
or whatever you want to talk about.
No, it's it is a historically very old city, but it's a very safe city because of our Office of Building and Code Administration, who are, you know, very much out in the public every day making sure everybody's up to code. We've got a lot of new construction in Alexandria, as we do all over the D.C. area, and that's District of Columbia, for those who... Yeah, for Fire Prevention Week for us, again, we're limited with... who can get out there, but our fire service personnel, this is the time, and it takes us probably about 3 weeks, every bit of 3 weeks, to get into all our elementary schools, which is our focus, public and private. We focus on fourth grades, and we feel that if we can get into a classroom for 20 minutes of a good presentation in every school, and you know, there might be 4 fourth grades in a school, if we can do that once a year in October, then we can go back during the year and pick up kindergarten and some other grades. So our firefighters and EMS personnel also are, they expect that every year, that we're going to go and blitz the fourth grades and deliver our message, which I know the theme of Fire Prevention Week this year is prevent burns, I believe. We, of course, are going to promote that message, and I will mention another item at the end of this. But every day, I think it's important that we promote home escape plans. I mean, it was maybe the theme 1 year, but every day, as far as I'm concerned, we can't promote it enough, because as a requirement in schools, students are trained to practice fire drills once a month. But as we all know, most fires happen when families are at home and at night. And a lot, when I always go into an audience and ask for a show of hands on who practice their home fire drills, a lot of kids raise their hands. But then when I ask them where their meeting place is, they don't really know what I'm talking about as much. So it's, you know, and when I ask the parents if they have thought about it, they said, well, our children are just babies yet, or, well, we live on one level, and so it's really not an issue. And so with, you know, every day we need to be teaching that lesson in October and every month. So our focus is, you know, still in the classroom in Alexandria, but we will have some open house events. I believe we've got a new fire station opening in Alexandria. Fortunate for that this year. So the other point I wanted to make, as far as the state of Virginia goes, we have a huge success, again, with the support of partnering and bonding together. Our coalition was successful in working with the legislators. A bill, House Bill 2578, which was signed by Governor Kane on July 1st, is on the subject of novelty lighters, or toy-like lighters, as they're known. This bill is designed to prevent lighters that look like toys from getting into the hands of children. This bill makes selling novelty lighters to anyone under 18 punishable by fine of up to $100. And it also requires stores to keep the lighters out of reach of children. Now, for some areas, you may not go into your local grocery store and see toy-like or novelty lighters, but in more rural areas, you might go into a general store, or you might go into a, you know, anywhere really, when you're traveling on the highway on vacation and see a lighter that looks like a cell phone. I'm sure you're all familiar with those. And we've mentioned Lieutenant Wanda Willis from Harrisonburg. Wanda and a group of other folks from the coalition were very, very dedicated to getting this legislation in front of the right folks. And if anyone needs ever a sample board of Wanda's novelty lighters, it's quite impressive. And she's brought it to Capitol Hill a few times. And, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words.
Yes, and thank you for mentioning that, because it is an emerging issue, problem. It seems intuitive that you would never give a child a cigarette lighter. But when you manufacture a cigarette lighter to mimic a toy or something that would be very appealing to a child, you know, they can't control themselves in that regard. They're going to be interested in it. I heard a story from one of my fellow firefighters who said that he discovered that his child had a novelty lighter, had it for well over a year. He had no idea that it was a lighter. It was set up like a cell phone, and the child, when looked at, he looked what the lighter can, or look at what the cell phone can do, and he lit this thing, and he was horrified because he knew the child had it for well over a year, and they didn't even realize that it was a lighter, and that's the kind of thing that that you have to worry about. The state of Oregon's fire marshal really got things going out west on this whole problem area, and the state of fire marshal website in Oregon has a lot of good information, and as well as certainly other resources that Patsy Ann has talked about already. But if people have not yet gravitated to this problem, at least they should start to look at it for legislation at the state level. And I think everybody sees this as a no-brainer, but it's still very much out there. It was coalitions that were able to get fire safe cigarettes passed in legislations, and I think at some point in time we're going to see the cigarette companies only making cigarettes with fire safe paper on them. This is another coalition that has really gained a lot of ground, and it what it does is basically reduces the risk to children, which is our, you know, most vulnerable population. I think that about does it. I had asked the audience if there was any questions, and nobody seemed to have anything at this time to talk about. But I really do want to thank everybody. What a great panel it's been, Bill and Billy and Dan and Patsy Ann, as well as our federal partners, Sandy Fasinoli and Teresa Neal. And we had I think a really good time here, and probably could talk for a couple hours, but I think these folks are getting tired. Some of them have already given presentations today here at Firehouse Expo, but I want to mention again, this is Fire and Life Safety Education and Prevention Podcast. We're coming live from the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland, July 24, 2009. Now, I promised that I would mention what the name of the fire was that occurred the same day as the Great Chicago Fire, and that was the fire in Peshtigo, Wisconsin. And it killed, amazing, I can't tell you exactly now, but hundreds of people. And it never even got a byline because the Great Chicago Fire was a metropolitan area. It occurred on October 8th, back in the 1800s. And there was a particular rash of fires that occurred throughout the Great Lake regions, and could be that because of dry conditions at that time of year that they were all related. But, of course, we relate Ms. O'Leary's cow as being the cause and origin of the Great Chicago Fire. So anyway, that does it, and certainly appreciate it. And, again, thank you all to the panel.
Thank you.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.